the Albert Mohler Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter. Dr. Mohler is president of the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary and one of the nation's leading theologians and cultural commentators. To get online with Dr. Mohler, call toll-free nationwide, 1-877-893-TALK. That's 1-877-893-8255. Now, here's your host, Dr. Albert Mohler.
Hello, America. Welcome to the Albert Mohler Program. Readers of the New York Times yesterday opened their paper in order to find the New York Times Magazine, and the cover story really does get your attention. It's entitled Young Gay Rights. Right spelled R-I-T-E-S, as in wedding rights. It's about young homosexual men getting married. It's a picture kind of like a Norman Rockwell scene of two young men enjoying a picnic, and the story is anything but Norman Rockwell. When you start looking at what's going on here, it is a story about why so many young men, young homosexual men in Massachusetts, have been getting married since same-sex marriage became legal there just a couple of years ago. And the reason for this is very simple. The expectation was that young men would not do this, that same-sex marriage is going to be primarily for lesbians, and it is, in that it's about a 2-to-1 ratio of lesbians to gay men who actually go for the same-sex marriage there in Massachusetts. But also, when you did have male couples, it was assumed that they would be older male couples, and yet there are 700, as of June 2007, 700 young men aged 29 and younger in Massachusetts who are in same-sex marriages. So you start looking at it, and there's a story. CNN thought it was a story. Now the New York Times Magazine thinks it's a story. And they commissioned a reporter by the name of Benoit Denizet Lewis to take a look at this. He is himself gay, and he's writing about what this means for gay culture. I think it's really important that we take a look at what this means for marriage. It is a fascinating, fascinating glimpse into a culture many evangelical Christians especially do not see. We're going to be talking about it today on the Albert Mohler Program. There's time even right now for you to go to my website at albertmohler.com. Just go to Albert Mohler, M-O-H-L-E-R.com, and you'll see this as the lead article at the top. You can go from my article, link right to the New York Times Magazine article. Take a look for yourself. Just a look at the cover will tell you a whole lot. Looking at the article will tell you even more. And we'll be talking about it. To join the conversation, call 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. Just to kind of tell you what we're going to be talking about. One of the interesting things in this is how these young homosexual male couples in involving themselves in what is called same-sex marriage actually begin to emulate heterosexual styles of how couples are. We're also going to be asking the question of how the homosexual culture is going to influence marriage. You see, it really goes both ways. You have this writer looking at how marriage has changed homosexual culture. I think it's of equal, perhaps even more importance, if we look at how the homosexual culture impacts marriage. Same-sex marriage is one of the most volatile issues in our country today, not just in Massachusetts, but beyond. And we as Christians have a big stake in this question. The phone number to join the conversation is 877-893-TALK. That's 877-893-8255. To your calls in just a moment. First, to review some issues in the news. Jeremiah Wright is back in the news. The former pastor of Illinois Senator Barack Obama, who really rocketed into controversy on the national scale when excerpts of his sermons became circulated in the media. You now have Jeremiah Wright putting himself back in the spotlight when he appeared in an interview last night with Bill Moyers and then also made some other statements and today spoke at the National Press Club. We're going to be listening in just a minute or two to what he had to say at the National Press Club, but I just want to give you a little background into this. There is a complex dimension to this controversy. It's about race, it's about the pulpit, it's about the church, it's about the gospel, it's about African Americans, it's about the national media, it's a cauldron of all kinds of issues. And if you've been listening to this program, you know we did an entire program on the question of Jeremiah Wright and especially African American theology. I had as my guest then Eric Redman, a pastor from Maryland. We were talking about the fact that our biggest concern is not with what he said, but with what he didn't say. That is to say, he didn't talk about the gospel of Jesus Christ. That does not appear to be the dominating message from this pulpit. And it's because when you start tracing back Jeremiah Wright's theological education, you start tracking back his doctrinal convictions, it's more about African-American liberation theology than it is about the gospel in terms of how sinners are saved from their sin by the substitutionary atonement of Jesus Christ. But I did defend Jeremiah Wright on this score. And this is that he has the right to say what many people have condemned him for saying, and that is that God will judge America. And we need to remember that there are all kinds of reasons why anyone that is animated by any kind of biblical worldview would want to say, you better believe God will judge America. But some of his statements go far beyond the pale of what most people would even believe would come from the pulpit. Now he is defending himself. And again, today at the National Press Club, in answer to a question, he had to say this about himself and the controversy.
As I said, this is not an attack on Jeremiah Wright. It has nothing to do with Senator Obama. It is an attack on the black church launched by people who know nothing about the African-American religious tradition. And why am I speaking out now? In our community, we have something called playing the dozens. If you think I'm going to let you talk about my mama and her religious tradition and my daddy and his religious tradition and my grandpa, you got another thing coming.
Now, I'm speaking as one who is not from the African-American tradition, but it certainly seems to me that that is an attempt to appropriate the entire tradition on behalf of his own sense of self-outrage. Whether that works or not, it's a political matter, and time will tell. But he's really saying that it's not about himself, and it's not even about Senator Obama. He says it's an attack on the black church, listen to this, launched by people who know nothing about the African-American religious tradition. Well, insofar as he means by that, a tradition formed in oppression that has directed much of its pulpit energy towards encouraging the congregation to persevere in spite of oppression, to stick in there and to stay in there in spite of prejudice, and to look for God for rescue from persecution, then we can certainly understand that. But let's remember that many of the sound clips we're talking about with Jeremiah Wright aren't things that even put into any context would make any kind of legitimate sense, such as his statement that AIDS was a conspiracy cooked up by people in Washington to get rid of black people. You know, that's just not going to pass the common decency for what should be said or claimed test. And that's what really focuses, I think, a great deal of the concern, controversy, and outrage towards Jeremiah Wright. But when it comes to his theology, that's what we're really talking about, because the political dimension of this will have to sort itself out. That's not my main interest. There are people out there who are trying to wonder exactly how will this play into the 2008 race for the Democratic presidential nomination. I'm not uninterested in that as a person, but that is not the stewardship of what we're dealing with on this radio program. Our terrain is more theological. And what we have tried to underline is that when it comes to Jeremiah Wright, my main concern is his liberal theology far more than his liberal politics. Not that they're disconnected and not interrelated, but the liberal theology is what's in the background. Now listen to that, because he really got into that as well, because he was asked a question. The question point blank was, is Islam a way to salvation? And when you listen to these words, just keep in mind that this is a man who honored Louis Farrakhan. That's another one of the issues that is really of controversy in this situation, is how he honored Louis Farrakhan. Even many of the people who have defended him on other things do not defend him on that. The leader of the Nation of Islam. Let's listen to what Jeremiah Wright had to say in answer to that question. Is Islam a way to salvation?
Jesus said, I am the way, the truth, and the life. No man cometh unto the Father but through me. Do you believe this, and do you think Islam is a way to salvation?
Jesus also said, other sheep have I who are not of this fold.
All right, in other words, he was very directly saying that he does not believe that that Jesus or faith in Christ is the only way of salvation, and asked specifically, not just about the generalities of the question of the exclusivity of the gospel, but in particular a question about Islam. Reverend Wright said, Jesus also said, quote, other sheep have I who are not of this fold, end quote. He did say that. But in the context, that's very clearly a reference to the fact that there will be people who will come to him who are not Jews. That's a statement about the universal reach of his gospel, not a question in which he said anything about the fact that there's any other way, because this is the same Jesus who repeatedly said exactly the opposite. There is no other way to come unto the Father but by him. And so it's just a reminder to us that even as the national media is particularly and understandably really focused on the 2008 race, and let's just remember that that's what's driving the news ratings and all the rest. You know, an American presidential election is a big deal. And I would be the very last to say it's anything other than a big deal. But let's remember that the kingdom of God is not riding on who is serving as president of the United States or chancellor of Germany or prime minister of Great Britain or, for that matter, just about anything else you can think of. And so even as it is important, it's not of eternal importance. The gospel is of eternal importance. And that's why I'm far more interested in that. Just remember that what the chattering classes and the talking head programs and all the rest out there are really trying to do is to keep your attention focused on the 2008 presidential race. It's an obsession to try to find how they can fill enough time 24/7 to keep you interested in talking about that. Now, I hope intelligent Christians are interested in that. But, you know, truly intelligent Christians are going to be looking beneath that to the even bigger issues that are going to be around long after the 2008 presidential race is decided. We're going to come back to talk about the young phenomenon of homosexual male marriage and what it says about marriage and homosexual culture. We'll be right back.
The Superior Gold Group, a precious metals firm, is proud to sponsor the Albert Mohler Program. You can get more information about buying gold at 866-432-8656.
Welcome back to the Albert Mohler Program. As I said, readers of the New York Times got quite a surprise perhaps yesterday, but then again, not a surprise, given contemporary developments in this culture. Let's put it this way. If readers of this magazine or of the New York Times, let's just say 20 years ago, would open the paper and this had fallen out, it would have looked like something of a futuristic vision that might happen. Now, when you look at this, the picture of two men who are supposedly newlyweds, two very young men enjoying a picnic together in kind of a Norman Rockwell scene, that's supposed to look like a new normal. And for a lot of people, at least in Massachusetts and in some other parts of the country, it is presented as a new normal. The New York Times Magazine is a very interesting barometer of what's going on in the culture. Now, my article posted last night begins with this quote from the article. "Honey, we may be married, but we still know how to have a good time, don't we?" That's said by Joshua Jansen, age 25, to his husband, Benjamin McGuire, also age 25. The New York Times Magazine and its writer, Benoit Denizet Lewis, has looked at this in its cover article, Young Gay Rights, R-I-T-E-S. And the article really does offer a fascinating glimpse into the lives of these young men and into their understandings of marriage and its place in American life. The reporter's interested in the story is a journalist who is himself homosexual, but the article deserves attention by a far larger readership, including those listening to this program. In their own way, these young men are demonstrating something important about marriage in America. Now, if you read the article, it's a huge article, and it really is pretty compelling as you begin to read it, because a lot of the early part of the article has to do with how these young men got together, and it's an interesting exercise in trying to make same-sex marriage look a lot like heterosexual marriage in terms of, well, the question of who popped the question to whom and how did they do it and how did the romance come together and how did the moms respond? Interestingly, according to this article, none of the parents involved of these young men really were opposed to them marrying a person of the same gender. At least that doesn't come out in the article. Many of them, especially the moms, seemed to celebrate it. The moms wanted to know who asked who. Isn't that cute? And they wanted to be involved in planning the wedding and all the rest. The one couple profiled in the article that really had kind of a secret wedding did so, they said, because they didn't want the falderall of family involvement and all the rest. But what's also interesting is that they begin to emulate heterosexual marriage. In other words, they're saying, we want marriage to be not only what it always has been, and what I'm going to very strongly argue the scripture makes clear marriage objectively is, the union of a man and a woman. They say, well, we want that. But even as they try to do that in terms of the same-sex construction here, they have to answer, well, some interesting questions, such as who's going to be the man in the relationship? One of the young men refers to himself as a gay housewife. You begin looking at this and you say, well, how does all that go together? Some of these young men say that they want to avoid anything that is, and this is the word they use, heteronormative, which means that's established as normative by the heterosexual community. But the reality is that when you have these individuals, both individuals in the couple being men, you can look at that and it doesn't look normal. The questions come, will one partner be more stereotypically male? Will the marriage be egalitarian? Will one partner be the gay housewife? All that's very interesting in this. Denizet Lewis, the author of this article, cites Frederick Hertz, the author of A Legal Guide for Lesbian and Gay Couples, who explains that many older homosexual male couples, quote, make a distinction between emotional fidelity and sexual fidelity, end quote. So you've got some of these young homosexual males saying, look, we want a monogamous relationship, and we mean that monogamy to being both emotional and sexual. And others are saying, well, the emotional, yes, but the sexual, not necessarily. One couple is made up of two young men, both named Brandon. As the author of the article writes, but the Brandons suspected they were untraditional when it came to their thinking about monogamy as they saw it. One enduring lesson of heterosexual marriage is that lifelong monogamy is unrealistic for most people, especially men. Quote, most straight people like to talk a great game about monogamy, Brandon A. said, but what are they really actually doing? Many of them have affairs at some point or break up because they want to sleep with somebody else. We are two guys. We're in our 20s. We haven't been sexual with that many people, and to pretend like we're never going to want to experience sex with another person until the day we die doesn't make sense to us. We're open to exploring our sexuality together in a way that makes us both comfortable. End quote. Well, one of the, in fact, the main issue behind this writer's interest, he is himself gay, he identifies himself that way in the article, is why these younger men are getting married. Because here's the stereotype. The stereotype that was expected was that, first of all, when you look at the entire gay community, lesbians will be far more likely to get married. That has held true. You're looking at a 2-to-1 ratio of lesbian and gay male couples. But among the persons getting married on the homosexual male side, the expectation was that it would be older and not younger men. But it turns out in Massachusetts, the state which has legalized same-sex marriage for the last several years, you're looking at the fact that a good number of younger male couples have come together. And so you have Benoit Denizet Lewis writing the article saying, well, maybe that's because the normalization of homosexuality when these kids were adolescent means that they don't have to act out their sexuality in their 20s, and they're instead ready to settle down and get married, much like heterosexual couples. This article is a noteworthy signal about the future of marriage. Now, if the writer is right, the legalization of same-sex marriage is changing the way some homosexuals are living their lives. In other words, it does appear that this is leading some younger homosexuals to have something of a more settled sex life in their 20s, even if, like many heterosexual marriages, their marriages end in divorce. In other words, same-sex marriage in Massachusetts is changing homosexual culture in some unexpected ways, and that's why the New York Times is interested. Now, I want to turn that around and ask the question, but how is homosexual marriage, the reality of same-sex marriage in Massachusetts, changing marriage? The background to that is that we as Christians have a Christian theology of marriage. Our concern about marriage is rooted in the picture that marriage provides. Marriage is a covenant, and it is the central institution for human society. The picture of marriage is the bringing together of those who are alike, that is, both made in the image of God, and different, one being male, the other being female. Out of this picture of difference brought together within covenant comes the gifts that flow from marriage. The tragedy of same-sex marriage is not the awkwardness and strangeness revealed in this article. I mean, all the stuff about who asked whom and, well, all the rest. It's the repudiation of the picture that marriage is supposed to provide. That repudiation represents great loss and confusion, but it also represents a violation of God's command concerning marriage and the purpose for our sexuality. Denizet Lewis's article raises at least one final thought. If the legalization of same-sex marriage is changing homosexual culture, is it also changing heterosexual marriage? You know, when I read the statement about older homosexual men, older homosexual male couples, dividing the issue of what they called emotional fidelity on the one hand and sexual fidelity on the other hand, I have to ask, is that not what some heterosexual couples are now experimenting with? Whether you want to call it an open marriage or what else, it's separating emotional fidelity and sexual fidelity, saying we can stay emotionally together even if one of us or both of us experiments with other sexual partners. You see, we're living in a midst of vast cultural change. It's taking place all around us. But a cover story like this in a magazine like the New York Times Magazine just compels our attention and says, folks, look, the culture is changing fast. Transformation is taking place all around you. How should intelligent Christians think about that? This is my question for you. The phone number is 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. What does all this say to you about the future of marriage? As intelligent Christians, how should we think about this? Not just in terms of how to suggest and argue and make the case that same-sex marriage is wrong, but how do we turn this around? Even the emulation of heterosexual marriage that's so clear in the story, how do we turn that around and say, you know, this is really also a reminder that in the end, the essentially heterosexual character of marriage shines through even when folks try to deny it. The phone number is 877-893-8255. We'll be right back with your calls on the Albert Mueller Program.
You're listening to the Albert Mohler Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter. To get online, call toll-free 1-877-893-TALK. That's 1-877-893-8255. Or go to www.albertmohler.com. Here again is your host, Dr. Albert Mohler.
Welcome back to the Albert Mohler Program. The story is found on the cover of the New York Times Magazine, dated yesterday. And it's a big article. And as a matter of fact, the New York Times Magazine is one of those literary journals that really does require some time to read. It's usually worthwhile, by the way, especially as it gives us a pretty clear indication of what's going on in American culture. The New York Times is avowedly pro-homosexual in its editorial page and its coverage, both in terms of news and culture. It's very clear about that. But in this particular article, it raises some questions about how marriage is changing the lives of young homosexual men. It is a fascinating article, and you have to read this, I think, with a very sensitive and carefully critical eye to say what's really going on here. Because to me, the big story is that the essentially heterosexual character of marriage comes shining through. In other words, here you have two men getting married, and yet all the trappings of marriage, all the customs of marriage and all the rest are so essentially heterosexual that even the moms of these young men start putting them into traditional male and female categories, as if one partner has to be playing the one part and the other playing the other part. Who's going to ask whom? You know, in this kind of thing, you know, the custom in heterosexual marriage very clearly is for the man to ask the woman. So what happens here? Well, does one more masculine, at least in terms of social construction and role playing, does he ask the question against the other one? I'm not making this stuff up. It's right out of the article. And one of the other issues in this article comes down to the distinctions between, gay men and lesbians when it comes to marriage. As a matter of fact, sometimes humor makes this point a whole lot better than anything else. So there's a series of jokes in here, a couplet of jokes that had to do with the differences between lesbians and gay men on the issue of marriage. Here it comes. What does a lesbian bring on the second date? The answer, a U-Haul. Okay, that's joke number one. It makes sense from within that culture. Here is its companion joke. What does a gay man bring on the second date? The answer, what second date? In other words, there's a clear difference, which is easily to discern and noted from within the homosexual community, between the ways that that lesbians and gay men tend to partner and come together. As a matter of fact, the stereotype, especially among young homosexual men, is that there really isn't much partnering in terms of any relationship or long-established relationship or binding relationship. And that's why the fact that there are, in fairly large numbers, young gay men getting married in Massachusetts, that's what attracted the attention of the New York Times and its writer. Now, as I mentioned, one aspect of this is the question of how the institution of marriage there, same-sex marriage, the legalization of same-sex marriage in Massachusetts is changing homosexual culture. That's what this writer is looking at. He's saying, look, you have gay young men getting married. They couldn't get married before. Now that they're getting married, they're not being, they're not acting out their homosexuality, as was true in the previous generations, through more promiscuous sex. And that's very blatant in the article. In other words, what had happened in the past is very clear about multiple partners just seeking to kind of figure out who they are. And now instead they're getting married. And so his point is that marriage is changing gay culture. Now, it's not at all clear that he thinks this is necessarily a good thing. Writing as an older gay man, apparently from within the context of the article, he points out that there are a good number of other gays who are looking at this and saying, other homosexual men looking at this and saying, hey, you know, what's the rush? I thought that marriage was something that maybe way out there in the future. You guys are marrying too young. This is what he writes. He writes, but young gay men today are coming of age in a different time from the baby boom generation of gays and lesbians who fashioned modern gay culture in this country. Or even from me, he says, a gay man in his early 30s. While being a gay teenager today can still be difficult and potentially dangerous, gay teenagers are coming out earlier and are increasingly able to experience their gay adolescence. That in turn has made them more likely to feel normal. Many young gay men don't see themselves as all that different from their heterosexual peers, and many profess to want what they've long seen espoused by mainstream American culture, a long-term relationship and the chance to start a family. Joe Court, a psychotherapist, And the author of the book entitled 10 Smart Things Gay Men Can Do to Improve Their Lives says, for many young gay men today, settling down in a relationship in their 20s or getting married if they live in Massachusetts will feel like a very natural thing to do. But my argument is, even when they do this, again, the essentially, objectively heterosexual character of marriage comes out, even in the conversation in this article. But to turn the tables, I think the legalization of same-sex marriage is also going to affect heterosexual marriage. I think it's good fodder for our conversation today. Give me a call at 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. You're listening to the Albert Mueller Program.
The Superior Gold Group, a precious metals firm, is proud to sponsor the Albert Mueller Program. You can get more information about buying gold at 866-432-8656.
Welcome back to the Albert Mueller Program. The phone number is 877-893-TALK. That's 877-893-8255. So here's the question. Someone comes up to you in your workplace. Someone comes up to you on your college campus, in your high school classroom. Someone comes up to you in the neighborhood talking right there as you're walking your dogs together and meet out on the sidewalk, and they say, so what's wrong with same-sex marriage? What's wrong with this? What kind of answer do you give? Now, let me just suggest to you that the reflex Christian answer is going to be, well, because it violates Scripture, which, of course, it does. And ultimately, that's all we should need. But the reality is that in order for that to be a compelling argument, someone's going to have to believe that the Bible is indeed the Word of God. Now, I'm still going to suggest that in the final analysis is our argument. But, you know, when you start thinking about how you would talk to someone about this, where would you start? What would you say? You could certainly argue from history and come back and say, look, marriage is and should be and always respected to be what it always has been. Just looking at the historical experience of mankind, humankind has found a way into a basically heterosexually normative pattern with a monogamous relationship. Basically, it's like what we would call marriage, and it's happened that way. You could make a pragmatic argument from social utility, pointing out that, just to indicate the obvious, that heterosexual marriage is the most conducive unit for the production and raising of children, which is a very important issue of the society's own future. If you were just a selfish society, that's one thing you'd have to have a big stake in, is in having and raising children. Then you could also look at it in terms of social stability, coming back to argue that marriage is very important just for the stability of the culture. For instance, the responsibility that the man in the marriage partnership and in the covenant of marriage, the responsibility he takes for his wife and offspring is very, very important. Anthropologists across, you know, global perspectives will tell you that where that is not found, the social stability begins to break down. You know, just look, for instance, at what's going on where you have paternity in question. You know, paternity is still a big question. That's why you now find paternity tests being sold at your local Rite Aid. It is because it's really important to know, who does this child belong to? What man is to take responsibility for this child? Do you not realize that that is now an ongoing argument? You know, it's very interesting, even in this postmodern age, when people say this shouldn't matter. Well, it does matter if you go into court where someone is trying to hold a man responsible for his offspring, whether it's in a child support hearing or some kind of other custody issue. You know, the society breaks down if you don't know to whom does this child belong, and especially when it comes to the man. There aren't that many maternity tests being done out there. It's paternity tests. Because isolating the male responsibility in this is so very, very important. So you start looking at that and you say, you know, how in the world does that work now? The artificiality of same-sex marriage really comes through in this article. Artificiality meaning that it is simply a replacement for what is fundamentally real. Artificial means it's not real. It means it takes artifice. In other words, it takes artistry to try to make something look real. That's the whole idea of artificial. And so that's what it takes here. It takes artifice. It takes art. It takes painting a new picture in order for same-sex marriage to be presented as normal. And that really begins to break down. Because just thinking about the historical functions of marriage, I mean, just take reproduction. Either on the female side or on the male side, something is desperately wrong with this picture. And so in order to talk about what would normally come with marriage, and notice it comes through in this article. You don't have to infer this, and I don't have to imply it. It's directly in the article where they say young men together, young homosexual couples wanting to settle down and start a family. Well, they can't start a family in the same way that a heterosexual family couple can start a family. It's going to have to be by adoption, or it's going to have to be by surrogate motherhood with someone outside of the partnership. You know, that again, it's just a testimony by common grace to the normativity of heterosexual marriage. And then you start looking at, you know, how indeed things are arranged within the life of the marriage. You know, this is where the feminists have a very interesting witness to bring to this. Because the feminists come in, and you know, in this program, we've looked at it time and time and time again, where you have feminists saying, look, even in our new feminized, you know, post-women's liberation, post-Title IX era, marriage still turns out to be, and they hate this. This is to them, well, as one of the leading feminists said back in the 1960s, you know, it's a domestic concentration camp in marriage. It's an oppressive institution. And why do they say that? They say because even when you have a feminist woman marrying a man who is ideologically compatible with feminism, when they actually get into the marriage, the stereotypical roles reemerge. There's something about marriage, in other words, in which the stereotypical roles, well, that's how they got to be stereotypes. They emerge. And so even when you have a heterosexual marriage, you know, that's ideologically feminized, it still usually doesn't work out that way. I mean, you certainly have some examples with house husbands and all the rest, but in reality, the stereotypical roles still tend to come through. Some of this is biology. I mean, there's simply no doubt about the nurturing relationship between the mother and the infant. But there's more to it than that, of course. Then you move over to the same-sex side. And one of the interesting things about this article is that even as they try to emulate heterosexual marriage, trying at the same time to avoid looking at all heteronormative, that's their word, even there, the same questions emerge. Who's going to do what? You know, when you start looking at all this, you realize that same-sex marriage is not just about marriage. It's not just about what is packaged as individual rights. It's not just about a political decision or a legal decision made in this culture. It's about what kind of picture is held up as the social expectation, the expectation in the culture that young people are raised to grow up, to emulate, and to fulfill. The picture in the scripture that we have of marriage is of persons, two people, not just any number, but two, both made in the image of God, both needing each other, one male and one female, alike in being made in the image of God, different, extremely different, one male, one female, but those differences brought together in the beauty of marriage such that the differences are not to be overcome, but are to find their fulfillment in that holy covenant. You see, anything less than that isn't just some kind of tacked-on accessory to marriage. It's not just a modification of marriage. It's a repudiation of marriage, because whatever this new thing is, it just isn't marriage. It just isn't the same picture. And we all ought to be able to see that. Back with final thoughts in just a moment. I'm Albert Muller. Welcome back to the Albert Muller Program. It is now late spring, and an awful lot of people are beginning to look at spring vacations, or at least it's late spring in terms of the planning cycle. And with school terms coming into the last weeks here and all the rest, a lot of people are looking toward the summer. New York Times is also out with a very interesting article, also from yesterday's paper, indicating that there is now a multi-hundred-million-dollar industry, not in vacations, but in, well, nakations. That's the word, naked vacations. Nude recreation, according to the New York Times, now represents a $440 million industry. That's $40 million up, or 10% up, just from 2001. It was only $200 million in 1992. The American Association for Nude Recreation, yes, there is such an organization, says that 20% of its members have a median household income of $106,000, and they spend more than $3,000 on travel just for their naked vacations. You start looking at all this, and it used to be this was the kind of hobby of some more hippie-oriented groups, but now, according to the New York Times, it is going upscale. You have, for instance, one woman, a 26-year-old bartender from Baltimore, who said about herself, when it comes to clothing, I consider myself a minimalist. Now get this, with this big societal push for becoming green, we need to kind of get back to our roots, and I thought maybe this would be a good way. Now, you know, folks, if you're trying to come up with a rationale for nude vacationing, somehow ecology just doesn't seem to me to be something that's going to pass much muster. Now, you start looking at this, and it's very, very interesting. And, you know, these people try to insist it's not about sex, it's about the vacation. Listen to this. The types of nude vacations have expanded, too. Vacationers can now roll out a mat at an all-nude yoga retreat, share banana bread with other guests at an all-nude bed and breakfast, gear up for nude mountain biking in California's high desert, and saunter around the decks of cruise ships chartered specifically for clothing-free travel. Now, folks, there's one part of this that did get my attention as this was brought to me and to my attention. There's a warning in here that a good number of people are signing on to these things without realizing that they are nude. So consider yourselves forewarned. When you see the advertisement for something that is clothing optional, that now does not mean you're deciding which clothing you will wear. It's not about choosing formal wear or athletic wear. It's about wear or nowhere. You know, you look at this, it's just another indication of what happens in a postmodern culture when the norms of the society are lifted off. And when you have claims that anything, no matter how aberrant, no matter how bizarre, is simply to be treated as normal. Well, when nacations are a major multi-hundred-million-dollar American industry, something's going on. It's all part of the big picture. We're watching a vast social transformation around us. And even as it's easy to look at something like this and snicker, it's even more important when we look at something like this and say, what does this tell us about this culture? And about what we as Christians have to do in facing these challenges. I'll see you tomorrow.
Thanks for listening, and be sure to visit our website, www.albertmoeller.com. You'll find archives of past shows and other important resources. You can also email your questions and comments. That's www.albertmoeller.com. Be sure to join us next time for the Albert Mohler Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter.